Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not just what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, what is C.S. Lewis's apologetic? Ken, Lewis remains an influential figure in contemporary Western society, and we just covered his latest film in the last podcast. But some people might wonder why and what was his apologetic? Even though you've talked about Lewis before, you're going to try to narrow in on that question today.
Yeah, you know, having saw this movie that, again, came out, The Most Reluctant Convert, it came out right before the holiday season. It kind of made me go back and think a little bit about Lewis, the writer, Lewis, the apologist. And of course, I have read many comments that secular people have made to some of the arguments that C.S. Lewis popularized. And there are times where, you know, there are people who just say, I'm not persuaded, I'm not convinced by some of Lewis's arguments. They're not substantive enough. They're not philosophically rigorous. But on the other hand, I'm not sure there is another Christian thinker of the 20th century who has had more influence on apologetics. I mean, I think it was Jack Collins, who is a professor at Covenant Seminary. We interviewed him some time back. He actually teaches a course about C.S. Lewis. And Collins says to me, he thought that all apologists are just kind of trying to mimic C.S. Lewis. And I immediately thought that of the comment that, you know, all rock stars are, you know, Elvis Presley imitators. And so I thought that was kind of interesting. But, you know, it does raise the issue of what did Lewis think about apologetics? What were some of his arguments? But what did he think were the value of them? I guess I'm relating the question, why are some people convinced and others not? So I want to talk a little bit about Lewis, his apologetics, and maybe what we can continue to learn from him. And again, I hope people will listen to the program we did on the Lewis movie. And I'm sure there'll come a time when that Lewis movie will be available on DVD, and you can go out and get a copy of it.
You know, Ken, just a kind of an offhand comment. We mentioned the influence of Lewis in his books. I was in a bookstore a few years ago, and the bookstores have been on the decline, although I read recently that they're making a comeback. I'm talking about actually walking into a bookstore. It looks like some of them are making a comeback. But when I went into the store, and, you know, I always like to go to the religion section to see what they have there. Usually you have, you know, stuff on spirituality, just a mishmash of anything but, you know, good Christianity. But then they had this whole section on C.S. Lewis, and I almost wanted to, you know, go say, where's your manager? Do you realize these are Christian books here? I think they're just capitalizing on the Lewis phenomenon.
Well, I think it illustrates what's really important. It sells.
That's right.
Well, you know, when you think about C.S. Lewis, I mentioned in our discussion of the movie that I think that there is a Lewis phenomenon. And Alistair McGrath, in his biography of C.S. Lewis, C.S. Lewis Alive, he says that Lewis is more popular today than he ever was. I mean, he has now been dead for 58 years, and yet his books remain popular. There is now this new movie about him. It seems to me that people like Tolkien and Lewis have remained popular. I think part of it is their skillful writing, but I think they're also popular, both Tolkien and Lewis, because they can give you a worldview from a literary point of view. That is, they can tell a story. I mean, when I do apologetics and when I talk about worldview, I kind of give you a conceptual scheme, a kind of worldview thinking, but they're able to paint a picture by telling a story that is very powerful. Now, what I want to talk a little bit about is this. I want to get into what is it that apologetic does that influences people, but I want to raise an interesting question that I think does relate to Lewis, and it is the question about whether it's possible to exaggerate the role of apologetics. Now, I know that sounds really strange because straight thinking is, in my mind, a program that is essentially about apologetics and the Christian worldview and about thinking clearly about worldview ideas. But nevertheless, I think that this idea comes forward. And you know, Lewis has a quotation where he says, "I have found that nothing is more dangerous to one's own faith than the work of an apologist. No doctrine of that faith seems to me so spectral, so unreal as one I have just successfully defended in a public debate." I think Lewis recognizes that there is a limit to apologetics. And in fact, one passage that I really appreciate, he says regarding the sustaining power that lies for the apologist, he says, quote, "A man can't always be defending the truth. There must be a time to feed on it. There must be a time to feed on it." And I think that's right. I mean, there have been people who have criticized Lewis. They have said, for example, that when Lewis shifted from apologetics, he shifted to the Chronicles of Narnia. And some people have proposed that he had this debate with a particular woman who critiqued him. And he felt kind of embarrassed that he had been corrected publicly. And so he kind of shifted away from his apologetic writings more to, you know, his fictional literature. Now, McGrath and other people, Michael Ward and others who I would consider leading C.S. Lewis scholars, say that's not the case. But it does, I think, bring us back to this issue of could we exaggerate the role of apologetics? And it leads me to another quotation. This is C. Stephen Evans. C. Stephen Evans is a Christian philosopher. By the way, he's an expert on Soren Kierkegaard. He has a couple of books out on Kierkegaard. And he has a little dictionary. It's called the Pocket Dictionary, Apologetics and Philosophy of Religion, published in 2002 by InterVarsity. But in the little preface here, he says, "In my own attempts at apologetics, why believe," that's the title of one of his books, he says, I caution against overestimating the importance of apologetics. I do not believe all Christians must explore such issues in order to have a reasonable faith in God as revealed in Jesus Christ. He then says, "I am convinced, however, that hard, honest thought about what Christians believe and why can be of great benefit to the church." What I simply want to bring out of that is that, you know, there have been many people who believed in God. Peter Kraft, who is a Catholic philosopher, he said in an online interview, he said probably 90 to 95% of the people who've ever lived on planet Earth believed in God. And he said that for them, it was common sense to believe in God. You know, I think there are times where we think that the only way somebody's ever going to come to faith is to hear the traditional arguments for God's existence, cosmological, teleological, moral, ontological arguments, or if they have heard a rigorous defense of the resurrection. Now, again, like Evans, I see great value in this, and of course, have dedicated a good bit of my life to being involved in apologetic organizations like formerly the Christian Research Institute. In the last quarter century, my time has been spent here at Reasons to Believe. But I guess the point I want to make is there are a lot of people who believe in God. And it doesn't carry the arguments, the evidence, the reasons behind it doesn't carry the same interest that it does for many of us. And there are a lot of people who read C.S. Lewis and it makes sense to them. There's just kind of a common sense awareness. Lewis's book, Mere Christianity, I mentioned in our last program, it influenced people like Francis Collins, who was the head of the Human Genome Project, who was the head of the National Institute of Health under both the Obama and Trump even the present administration under Biden. He was influenced by Mere Christianity. Chuck Colson, hotshot attorney for Richard Nixon, who was in prison because of his involvement in the Watergate scandal. It was part reading C.S. Lewis that led him to faith. And, you know, I think that there are times that we can kind of exaggerate the role. Now Lewis also says here, and again, I want to come back to it. He says, a man can't always be defending the truth. There must be a time to feed on it. You know, as a Christian, I think you need to tie your theology very closely to your apologetic interests and endeavors. You have to live out the Christian faith. You know, it is not just a series of making arguments, but it is also about being a person of prayer, developing Christian character. You know, and the more I think about that, I mean, of course, there was a cataclysmic rock in the apologetic community when it was revealed that there was a leading Christian apologist who was leading a double life. And, you know, it raised the questions of what does it mean to be a witness for Christ? What does it mean to be able to influence people? And of course, I'm speaking about Ravi Zacharias, you know, where apparently a lot of things that were known publicly about him, in his private life, he was leading a very different life. And, you know, so it raises questions about the kind of lives we live as Christians and the kind of things that are important to us. And I appreciate that people like C.S. Lewis and C. Stephen Evans recognize that as important as ideas are, and as important as it is to defend the truth, to pursue the truth, that it is also about the grace of God in our lives. It is also about having a relationship with God. Not merely an intellectual relationship, but a relationship with the Lord that transforms our life. And you know, what's interesting about this is there is an old saying, be careful about meeting your heroes. And of course, what's meant by that is they all have feet of clay, right? Well, there are times where you can meet people. I'm sure there are people who have probably met me and have said, you know, I thought Ken was, a lot more Christian in his orientation. Maybe he was curt to me, or, you know, maybe he didn't have much time for me, or he seemed kind of, self-interest in the way that I interacted with him. But I also have to say that there have been times where I have met Christian leaders where they really confirmed for me that they were not just intellectuals, they were kind, they were gracious, they were wise. I remember meeting Michael Green. Dr. Michael Green wrote a lot in the field of evangelism and apologetics. I remember reading his books when I was very young Christian. A few years ago, I went to England and I had the great opportunity to give a co-lecture with him on the question, do all religions lead to God? And I was very humbled because I remember how much his books meant to me. He has a book out on Jesus that he wrote a number of years ago. I think it's just an amazing book. It's had deep influence on me. It influenced the way I wrote my book, God Among Sages. But when I met Michael Green, he was funny. He was gracious. You know, he was a real person. I remember talking to him and I said, you know, you've written 50 books. I said, how did you do that? And he said, well, you know, some of them have been flops. Some of them just, you know, they crashed and burned. And I was like, okay, well, that's good because some of mine haven't sold all that well either. So thank you for that. But he was a real person. He had been married to his wife for 61 years. And I got to see that it's not just the books we write. It's not just the academic credentials or the arguments themselves, as important as all of that is. Remember, Lewis tells us that you have to have good philosophy if for no other reason to answer bad philosophy. But I also saw it in that these people were genuinely Christian. And I remember Walter Hooper saying in an interview with Eric Metaxas, you can see that on YouTube, by the way. Just type in Walter Hooper interviewed by Eric Metaxas. And Walter Hooper says that he thought, and this is Lewis's secretary who met him in 1963, then became an advisor to Lewis's literary estate for many years. I think it's true that many of us recognize the influence of Lewis was really accelerated because of what Hooper did, getting Lewis's books back into print, keeping them in print. Hooper said that he thought C.S. Lewis believed the gospel in the same way that the apostles Peter and Paul believed the gospel. I mean, that's a pretty amazing thing to say something like that. I mean, to have that kind of trust, to have that kind of confidence, you know, and so one thing I want to point out very, very clearly in this broadcast is that apologetics is not merely a matter of the mind. Now remember who's saying that to you. I pursue the life of the mind to the glory of God. I'm a bookish person, I'll admit. I'm sometimes more comfortable around books than I am meeting new people. I love ideas, and you know, people like Mortimer Adler turned my world upside down when he taught me how to think and reason and all of these kinds of things. But, you know, at the end of our life, people are going to ask, well, what kind of husband was Ken Samples? What kind of father was Ken Samples? What kind of friend and coworker was Ken Samples? And I think it's important to realize that, yeah, we want our arguments to be cogent. We want our arguments to be well-grounded and persuasive. But it is very important that apologists have a Christian life, that they be a person who has a church life, who has a family life, who has, you know, that doesn't live the double life. We don't want to live three lives, have three lives where we have a public life, a private life, and then a secret life. You know, when people write about ethics, it's very important to stay away from compartmentalization. You know, I'm one way with you, but another way with somebody else.
One of the point you're making here is certainly supported in one way in scripture. And that is, I've always been especially attracted and spent time thinking about the prayers that Paul offers in his various epistles. And most of those prayers are focusing not so much on our making arguments for the truth of God and the gospel, but they're on how do you live the Christian life, and do you know God, and are you growing in wisdom and knowledge and understanding of his ways and purposes in your life?
Yeah. Now, you know, now saying all of that, I still come back to a point that I think is awfully important, and that is that we are saved by grace. That is, we're not saved by trying to be holy. We are saved by grace, and it's through faith, but it is a faith that does work. If you have a faith that doesn't work, it's not authentic faith. But of course, if you look at anybody's life, I mean, I've studied the life of C.S. Lewis, and I've discovered that he was really a human being. He was flawed. He was broken. He made mistakes in life, sometimes big mistakes. But I think it is very important in the enterprise of apologetics to not only be a truth seeker, to defend the truth, but it is also important to be a person who cares about the values of Christianity. If I could also, Dave, mention Paul. I mean, when I read 1 Corinthians 13, not easy to read that book. It's not easy to read that chapter where Paul says that, you know, I could understand all mysteries. Now, I think Paul's being hyperbolic there because human beings are finite and limited, and they could never under any circumstance understand all mystery. But even if we could, which would mean I understood the Trinity, I could totally comprehend the Trinity, or I could totally comprehend the incarnation or the atonement. Or Dave, I could comprehend mathematics and philosophy and logic. Paul says, if you haven't loved, you're nothing. And that's a very powerful statement. How do we relate, you know, to other people? And so it's not just a matter of arguments in the mind, but I again want to illustrate that none of us measures up. None of us keeps the commandments perfectly. I mean, Jesus is pretty rough. You know, he says, you know, it's not only a sin to commit adultery, but it is a sin to look upon a woman in a lustful way. It's not just a sin to engage in the terrible act of murder, but to hate someone. And so, you know, you read the Sermon on the Mount. When I read the Sermon on the Mount, I think I need a savior. I have fallen and I am broken and I need God's forgiveness, but I also want to be transformed. And I want God to use me. And he's only going to do that if I'm interested, not just in arguments, I'm interested in love. I'm interested in faith, hope, and love. I'm interested in relating to other individuals. Now, in light of that, I would like to talk a little bit about some of C.S. Lewis's arguments. And again, you know, I read critics of C.S. Lewis, and it's interesting. Sometimes they will look at an argument that I find very engaging. I find cogent. I find persuasive. I think, wow, this is really a sound way of thinking. And some skeptics look at it and say, ah, you know, it really isn't very convincing. It's just one man's opinions, and they don't carry a great deal. Well, again, I want to bring that point we made earlier. And not everybody is a scholar. Not everybody's going to pore over these arguments and read philosophical treaties. Not everybody is going to look at the scientific arguments and, you know, try to work through all of their premises. Most people are looking for, I think, common sense to show them that their belief in God, their belief in Christianity is reasonable. But when it comes to skeptics, when it comes to other people, we dig deeper, right? Well, I want to present a couple arguments that have meant a lot to me. And the first one comes from a couple of C.S. Lewis's books. In my book, Classic Christianity, Classic Christian Thinkers, I call this the argument from Jesus's identity. And Lewis in that book, Mere Christianity, he says, you really can't come to the conclusion that Jesus was only human and was merely a great moral teacher. And the problem is because he makes divine claims. And here's what Lewis says. He says, a man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level with a man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Now, of course, people bring criticism to this argument. It's been popularized into what is called the trilemma, Lord, liar, lunatic. Jesus is either a liar or a lunatic, but those options don't fit with what we know about Jesus, therefore he has to be Lord. So some of these arguments have appeared more popularly. I might also say that this argument, as Lewis gives it in Mere Christianity, has been popularized. If you read a little more deeply, he develops these arguments, but here is here's the way I think about this argument. I think the idea that Jesus is claiming to be the divine human Messiah, it rings true. And I think that this is really a type of abductive inference to the best explanation type of argument. So I'm going to give you seven premises here. And this is the way I read Lewis's argument. So premise one, a fair reading of the Gospels has Jesus making claims to deity. That is, he seems to view himself as an extension of Yahweh. He, you know, when the Jewish religious leaders press him, he reaches into the Old Testament and he applies the most sacred expression of God, I am, to himself. Not only does he make claims to be divine, but he says he can forgive people's sins. He can answer people's prayers. He says things like, I'm going to judge humanity. I'm going to raise the dead. Well, those are only things Yahweh can do. So premise one, I think a fair reading of the Gospels is Jesus seems to have a self-conscious that he's divine. Premise two, it's highly implausible that strict monotheistic Jews would invent a divine human Messiah. I think that's also a very powerful premise that you're not talking about a Hindu context. You're not talking about a Greco-Roman polytheistic context. You are, after all, talking, Jesus is himself a Jew. He comes out of Second Temple Judaism. It's highly implausible that a monotheistic Jew, Jesus, would talk about him being divine human. So this is extraordinary. Premise three, the Gospels as a genre of literature show no typical signs of being mythical or legendary. Now that's where I think Lewis comes in strong. I mean, Lewis knew a lot. In fact, he considered himself an expert about mythology and legends. That was his field. He understood the Greco-Roman and various other mythologies. And he said, look, I'm not a New Testament scholar, but I am a scholar of myth and legends. And the New Testament doesn't have the typical signs of being legendary or mythological. Premise four, Jesus's personality, his moral character, his influence, and the monumental events of his life make it highly implausible that he was lying about his identity. I think that's a powerful point. I mean, I have grown up and the most glowing thing you could say about someone is they're Christ-like. I mean, Jesus is the most consequential figure in history, certainly in Western history, I think all of history. And Jesus has the qualities and characteristics, his personality, the way he lives. I remember Houston Smith, who I'm not sure was a Christian. I remember Houston Smith was, his parents were missionaries to China. Where Houston Smith landed about the world's religions, I was never quite sure. I always liked him because he wrote sympathetic about all the world's religions. But Houston Smith says, the thing about Jesus is this, it's not just that he preached the Sermon on the Mount, he appeared to live it. To live the Sermon on the Mount? In fact, Peter Crafts said this, if the apostles invented the Jesus of the Gospels, we should worship them because they're a lot better than Lewis and Tolkien. Premise five, Jesus's personality, moral character, influence, and the monumental events of his life make it highly implausible that he was delusional about his identity. So we've got these two options. One, that he's lying about his identity, but then the cognitive dissonance is the greatest moral character in history would be lying about who he was. It doesn't fit. Now, could Jesus have been delusional? Well, I do know that there are people in mental institutions who suffer so deeply from mental health disorders that they think, you know, they're some type of deity, or they think they're more than they are. And yet I have read Christian psychiatrists and psychologists who have said that sometimes when they engage in therapy with their clients, they will merely read passages from the New Testament, and that there is a calming sense of this. So our options, a liar or delusional. Now, premise six, there do not appear to be any other plausible explanation for Jesus's identity. Now, by the way, in my book, Without a Doubt, I expand Lewis's argument, and I present his argument as, is Jesus a man, myth, madman, menace, mystic, Martian, or Messiah? I always tell people, do you know how long it took me to come up with all those M words? It was, but what I'm doing there is I'm actually trying to expand. Well, maybe people living today who might think, well, maybe he's an Eastern mystical person. Maybe he's a guru. Or with the thinking about UFOs, maybe he's a Martian. So I try to include some other fields that might be possible options. They weren't for Lewis. And so I think in light of Lewis's argument, if you can rule out that Jesus was merely legendary, that we are dealing with New Testament gospels that are something like modern biographies, and that we have and these gospels appeared within a pretty short time period of when the events really happened, then I think if we operate abductively and say, well, what is the best explanation about the self-consciousness of Jesus? Then I think we can draw the conclusion on point seven, and that is, therefore, as amazing as it seems, the most plausible explanation is that Jesus was telling the truth, and he is God in human flesh. Now, again, you can go back to those premises and you can say, well, Jesus really never had that consciousness. He Christians kind of deified him. There's a lot of myth and legend, but again, I don't find that criticism to really carry a lot of weight. I mean, the Gospels were written somewhere between 50 and 90 AD. So 50, the 50s would be a very conservative dating of the Gospels. And 90 would be a more progressive or liberal view. And there may be some flux in there. I mean, if Mark was the first Gospel written, maybe Mark and Luke and Matthew, maybe John came later. But again, if Jesus died in 30 AD or 33 AD, like most scholars believe, I mean, if it's in the 50s, 60s, 70s, or 90s, there could still be people living who knew about these things. In my own family, I remember John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy being assassinated. I remember Martin Luther King being assassinated. In fact, in the year 2020, with all the social unrest in the country, I thought to myself, this is a lot like 1968. When King was assassinated, the great civil rights leader, then Robert Kennedy, in light of the Democratic convention in California, he was shot, the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. Then later that year, there was the Democratic convention in Illinois, in Chicago. There were fights between the police and the rioters. And I thought, man, this, and the Vietnam War was raging. And I was thinking, man, this country's coming apart. Well, I can remember that. And it's more than 50 years ago. And so this is an argument in my mind that I think is pretty strong. And again, I'm trying to do it abductively. I'm saying, well, what is the alternative explanation? I don't think the idea that we have a legend or we have a myth, and of course, some skeptics have adopted, not all of them, some skeptics have adopted a mythical view of Jesus, that he never exists, that he is purely mythological. I don't think that that is, well, I would put it this way. Then I think most of the people from a Greek and Roman historical point of view, you can't know either. I mean, the classical studies, I think, almost have to fold up and go home if that's the case. So I find this argument to be gripping. I do think that if we can rule out legend and the idea that Jesus is a liar and that he's delusional, these are so difficult to accept that I think we are back to, did Jesus claim these things? And why would a Jew under any circumstance claim to forgive other people's sins? Didn't Jesus know this would be the height of blasphemy? Thus, I think this is a common sense argument. And I think that that's the way Lewis was reasoning.
It's amazing to me how easily some of the atheists will dismiss it on the grounds that the reliability of the New Testament.
Yep. And again, but as we come back at that, we have a lot of manuscripts. You know, we have a lot of early manuscripts. We know a lot more about Second Temple Judaism. I would say, who was it that said this? Might have been Michael Green, or I'm maybe thinking of somebody else. They said that the Gospels are the most critiqued, ridiculed, and scrutinized books in the history of the world.
I can believe that.
And yet, there are leading intellectual scholars in the world who believe it's true. The message is true. Hmm. Now, let me move on to unless you guys want to comment, I want to move on.
I just want to emphasize one more time that I think Lewis's great understanding and depth in literature and mythologies, that he, more than anyone, could express an opinion on the nature of the New Testament writings and you know, his viewpoint that they are more historical and like newspapers rather than just some made up mythology. He has some very remarkable statements where he criticizes scholars who will say, you know, the Gospel of John is a hymn or some mythology, or he just says it's just utter nonsense.
And I think if you go back to that idea, that, I mean, there is a very popular idea that the idea is that Jesus didn't think he was divine, but those words are placed in his mouth and it happened over time. So, you know, Jesus was a great moral teacher. Maybe he was like a martyr, and maybe it was kind of like Martin Luther King. You know, a great orator, a great teacher who was killed, and mythologies grew up, and then later he was deified. So the thought is, you know, by the time you get to Chalcedon in 451, you have a divine Jesus, but he didn't start out that way. So you've kind of, the Gentiles, after all, right? Gentiles have all kinds of gods, and they've made a god out of a man who was merely a great moral teacher who was a martyr. Well, here's, I think, a devastating comeback and makes that position untenable. New Testament scholars have discovered that there are creedal statements and even hymns in the New Testament. And these creedal statements, and here, of course, I'm thinking of not only 1 Corinthians 15, but I'm thinking of Colossians 1, Philippians 1. And these are statements that are creedal or hymns, and they go back to primitive to Christianity. They go back to when the church was exclusively Jewish. And the interesting thing is they have the highest Christology. Philippians 2, who being in form God, right? I think this argument is cogent. I think this argument makes common sense. Now, I want to talk about at least one or two more before we lose all of our time. Here's an argument that Lewis is very popular for. It's the moral argument, and I reread Mere Christianity pretty frequently. In the early part of the book, he talks a lot about this. So in Lewis's book, Mere Christianity and the Abolition of Man, he lays out a moral argument. And he says this, he says in Mere Christianity, my argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust, but how had I gotten this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing the universe with when I called it unjust? Now here I'm going to lay out this argument, and I'm going to frame it this way. Premise number one, there is a universal moral law. There is a universal moral law. Now are you going to deny that? Are you going to deny that it is wrong for people to murder innocent people? How about torturing children? How about, by the way, sex trafficking? So you go out and you find young boys and young girls, you kidnap them, and you sell them into a life of prostitution, and you benefit financially from those people being kidnapped and trafficked. I mean, they're slaves after all. I remember one scholar saying that if there is a hell, the traffickers are going to be at the hottest place. I mean, I can't imagine something more cruel, something more inhumane than something like that. So are there universal moral laws? Can you think of a context where that would be okay? I mean, and Lewis does that. He says, think of a world where, you know, being cruel and being traitorous would be a good thing. You know, there are moral principles that we don't seem to be able to say, well, that could just be relativistic, or maybe that's not a universal truth. So premise one, I'm willing to defend it. There is a universal moral law. Premise two, if there is a universal moral law, then there is a moral lawgiver. I mean, if there is this law that you shouldn't sell young boys and girls into a life of slavery and prostitution, where did that law come from? How is it grounded? How is it justified? I mean, are you going to say if there's no God and our evolutionary background is accidental, are you still going to say that, you know, in order for me to thrive and have money, I'm going to enslave people and I'm going to benefit from them living in a life of rape and prostitution? No, if there is a universal moral law, there seems to be a moral lawgiver. And if there isn't, then again, how do you ground morality? How do you justify it? I remember, you know, people like Lawrence Krauss have said, well, maybe beliefs like belief in God or belief in an afterlife or objective morality. Maybe these were, by believing these things, they gave us survival advantages. But of course, what I would say is, but you say they're not true. So evolutionists produce false beliefs in our mind to help us survive. That is, it doesn't make sense. Michael Shermer argues that way. You know, that maybe these beliefs that we now all know are false, they were put into our minds. Well, if evolution puts false beliefs in your mind, then you have no reason to believe that evolution is true or that atheism is true. Premise three, if there is a moral lawgiver, it must be something beyond the universe, God. That is, to make it objective, to make it universal, it can't just be one part of the system. It has to be something that is beyond it. The universe, our experience in the cosmos, our life in the cosmos is lived out within the context of that universe or something beyond. Therefore, conclusion, therefore there is something beyond the universe. It's God. And Lewis says that this is common sense, you know, in Mere Christianity. He says, you know, you have two people arguing and one says, hey, I gave you some of my orange. How, you know, give me some of yours. He says people argue about these kinds of things all the time. And Lewis is a defender, not only in Mere Christianity, but also in the abolition of man, that there is a moral sphere of life and that we rest within that. Now, one more argument, that is, that's a little difficult to understand and to present, but I'm going to give it a go anyway, because this is straight thinking. We pull off the miraculous here. Well, it's the argument from reason. And I want to read a little bit from the case for Christianity. This would have come in the context of Mere Christianity and Lewis's presentation on the BBC. He says, supposing there was no intelligence behind the universe, no creative mind. In that case, nobody designed my brain for the purpose of thinking. It is merely that when the atoms inside my skull happen, for physical or chemical reasons, to arrange themselves in a certain way, this gives me, as a byproduct, the sensation I call thought. But if so, how can I trust my own thinking to be true? It's like upsetting a milk jug and hoping that the way it splashes itself will give up a map of London. And if I can't trust my own thinking, of course, I can't trust the arguments leading to atheism, and therefore have no reason to be an atheist or anything else. Unless I believe in God, I cannot believe in thought. So I can never use thought to disbelieve in God. Now, that's very controversial. And you have people who take differing sides of this position. And there are even Christians, by the way, who disagree with Lewis here. And there are plenty of secularists who disagree. But let me lay it out in a formal argument. Premise one, the reliability of reason and human rationality cannot be justified if it comes from a non-rational, non-mindful source. Now, let's think about that. The reliability of reason and human rationality cannot be justified if it comes from a non-rational and non-mindful source. There's no mind behind the universe. Human reasoning came from a non-mindful source, and it came from a mechanistic, naturalistic, accidental process. And so my ability to reason, my ability to be a rational being, came from a non-rational source, from a non-mindful source. It's the product of evolution, which is not a person. Premise two, atheistic naturalism posits reason and human rationality as coming from a non-rational, non-mindful source, random physical processes of evolution. Conclusion, point three, therefore atheistic naturalism cannot justify the reliability of reason and human rationality. Now, again, not everybody accepts this. There are even Christian philosophers who are not persuaded by Lewis. There are others who are. My friend Victor Reppert, who is a Christian philosopher. Think of Alvin Plantinga with his evolutionary arguments against naturalism. To me, this makes sense. It makes sense that mind would come from mind, reason would come from reason, personhood would come from persons. If God exists and God is like an infinite mind, it's not difficult for me to think he might create finite minds. But if mind and personhood and rationality come from a physical source that lacks all these qualities, then I think you have extraordinary claims. And to me, it's more commonsensical that we are rational beings, we are personal beings, we're moral, we have moral and rational capabilities because they came from a source that possesses that rational and moral capabilities. Now again, there are people who criticize this, there are people who try to find holes in it, but they make a lot of sense to me. And I think they make a lot of sense to a lot of people. And I think when people read Lewis's books, there is kind of that common sense apologetics. And I will say again, I think from a worldview point of view, if I am an atheist and I hold a naturalistic worldview, I think explaining things like morality and reason and purpose are difficult to justify. And on the other hand, I think theism is able to explain those things well. Now, that's not to say there aren't challenges to theism and to Christian theism in particular. We could talk about the problem of evil. We could talk about, why has God made a world where there's so much evil, pain, and suffering, and other types of issues. But if I can come back to what Lewis said about can't always be doing apologetics, you have to feed on it. See Stephen Evans, who says you can sometimes exaggerate the role of apologetic arguments. If we go back to scripture, the heavens declare the glory of God, Psalm 19. We have a conscience that God has created within us, and we have seemingly an inbuilt awareness of God. And, I think when it comes to questions of problem of evil or the hiddenness of God, these are often common criticisms against Christian theism. I think we also need to come back to the idea that to come to the Lord, you have to come on his terms, not on yours. You have to face your own brokenness. You have to face your own, as C.S. Lewis says, you have to be willing to excuse the indecency in other people that God forgives in you. And I would say from an inside baseball point of view, there are times I think where maybe non-Christians are not aware of how moral considerations play a critical role in all of this. Christopher Hitchens said, I don't want God to exist. It's like living in North Korea. You're never free. I want to be free from God. St. Augustine, of course, turns it around and says, no, it's a great comfort. You're never alone. Even when you're in pain, even when you're in despair, no matter what condition you are, God's always there. Closer to you than a brother, closer to you than a friend, closer to you than your own spouse. So guys, I think Lewis has engaging arguments. They, of course, can go to a deeper level when philosophers and scientists and historians look into all of these matters. But I think part of the reason why there is a Lewis phenomenon is that he's a very gifted thinker and a very gifted writer. And I've noticed from reading through Mere Christianity just recently, man, there's a lot in a single paragraph. Mm-hmm. You know, Mere Christianity is a very brief book, but when you dive into the content, it's like, whoa, he's saying a lot in that short paragraph. Mm-hmm. Well, there are some recommendations, Joe and Dave. I'd like to encourage people to read some of these books. You know, I've noticed, by the way, now maybe this is not meant to be the case, but you know, there are a lot of material on YouTube that you can listen to. I was never a big fan of books on tape, but I have become a big fan because I have a lengthy commute and I listen to books on tape, and I keep my hands on the steering wheel at 10 and 12 and I'm careful of the guy in front of me, but I love listening to all this material. And I know a good number of people do that with our program, Straight Thinking. They listen while they're exercising, they listen while they're commuting. You know, there are a lot of great sources. Read Lewis's books. If you'd like an introduction to Lewis, Chapter 9, Classic Christian Thinkers, I introduce him and talk about some of his books. But there are great books out there about Lewis and about Lewis's ideas.
All right. Thank you for those, Ken. People have been reading your books as well. Here are a couple of comments that have come in from readers. Here's one. My wife is now reading Christianity Cross-Examined, and she's enjoying it as much as I did. I also gifted your book to a neighbor of mine that has been struggling with the politics of Christianity. I thought she would benefit from your ecumenical stance, along with the many gems you lay out in that book. Take care, Jordan Kirschke. And I know that was one of your goals in that book. I think you have a chapter on that as well, Christianity Cross-Examined. So thank you for that, Jordan. Here's another one, Ken. I reference A World of Difference often. Excellent book, Chris Camp. And finally, one more. I love your book, A World of Difference, Professor Samples. Such a great resource. Angie Paris Nowan Kudu, if I got that right. So thank you, Angie, Chris, and Jordan for those comments. We appreciate them. Keep them coming. You can reach Ken via his Twitter handle at RTB_KSamples. Let us know what you think. Or if you have a question that we haven't covered on the podcast, Ken is certainly open to addressing those as well. Don't forget to subscribe to the Reasons to Believe podcast on Apple Podcasts, Podbean, and Spotify, or anywhere you listen to your podcast. By subscribing, you'll get the episode delivered to you each week. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory, but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.